Radio.
Hello?
Hello, this is Robert?
Hello?
Robert? Hello?
Hello?
Robert, can you hear me? This is weird.
Hello?
Are you insane?
They are insane!
In the hands of an adolescent.
It is a cellular peptide cake.
But Red Frosting.
It does like you.
Mr. Kim.
Hi, Christopher. I'm Nero.
How you doing, Mike?
You will die slowly, Duras.
You will die slowly, Duras. The guy who said this, the guy who created that character, put the Klingon world, the empire, the lifestyles in a whole new direction. Up until this point in time, we had two kind of Klingons. We had kind of sad, mopey Worf, who kept on talking about honor and talked about the strength of being a Klingon, and yet he'd always get his ass kicked just to show how powerful whatever that alien was that week was fighting them. And then we had kind of the angry pirate Klingons who just grunted and growled and talked about honor, and there was never any middle ground. I guess Claire was sort of like, she was also kind of the middle ground of that too, but there was nobody who was really kind of the quintessential embodiment of a Klingon. We hadn't seen that for 25 years, since like Kor and Kang and those guys. And then Robert O'Reilly shows up, and he wrecks everything that happens in that episode. He walks in there with that first line. He says, "You will die slowly, Duras," with those gigantic eyes, which like in standard definition, like almost leapt off the screen. He just owned that role. He just chewed up the scenery in the most beautiful, perfect way and defined. He triangulated. Again, we were talking about we have sad Worf, we have angry Klingons, and now we have a nuanced Klingon, a Klingon who wants things specifically. He wants power. He wants to get it in a certain way. He doesn't want to just fight his way there. He wants to go through kind of political machinations. He's a politician, but a Klingon politician. He's also a fun-loving guy. He laughs more than any other Klingon we've ever seen in any of the episodes. He's a fun-loving guy. And he helped triangulate what being a Klingon meant for the rest of the series and for the rest of all the other series. He was great. And when he called out Kalis, like basically like talking to Jesus Christ, like, "Oh, by the way, Jesus, what did John look like? I don't even know if that's right. You know what did you guys eat at the Last Supper?" He calls out Kalis. You don't do that. Gowron did. Gowron did with gigantic eyes. He fought Kalis. No one fights Jesus. He fought Jesus. And he won. I have a cold. So when Robert O'Reilly told me that he wanted to speak today, I said yes. And after two bad attempts, I don't know what was going on. I tried to make it work with Google Hangouts, which has worked every other single time, but now we got this weird ringing you heard earlier. And then after that, I tried to do it with FaceTime, and he couldn't hear me, which is the problem with FaceTime and trying to record it off of Audio Hijack. So we went old school. I just held the phone right up to the receiver. So what you're hearing right now is a great interview with Chancellor Gowron. Robert O'Reilly.
Hi, Mike.
Can you hear me now, Robert? How's that?
Yeah, much better. Much better.
You know, for all the technology, you know what I'm doing right now? I'm holding my iPhone over my microphone and doing speaker mode.
Oh, well, it's working perfect.
The more we come up with technology, the worse it gets. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. It's like, drives us crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Robert, I'm so glad to have you talking to me on this podcast. I saw you a little bit at the Star Trek Vegas convention, just for a brief second, and you were kind enough to agree to be on this podcast. Now, have you recovered from that convention?
It was a great convention, the Vegas convention, 50th anniversary of the Star Trek, and it was huge. I think it was 5 days, and it exhausted us, and we had a lot of fun, and I think the fans had a lot of fun, and it was great. It was I enjoyed it, and all the people I was with enjoyed it a lot. So
Now you say we and the people. Now who's your crew? Who do you hang out with in Vegas?
Well, you know, obviously J.G. Hertzler, who's played Martok.
Yep.
And our makeup guys and just friends who, you know, show up at conventions. And most of them live in Vegas, and you know, wherever we go, we sort of, you know, had friends through the years. I've been doing this for, believe it or not, about 25 years, I think.
Wow.
Starting in, I think I did my first convention in 1992. So that's
wow.
It's a lot of years. You know, maybe it was 91, but it was somewhere around there. So you get to know people, you know, through the years, and get to be friends with some, and you know, it's So anyway, that's pretty much who I met, you know, going there and being there and enjoying Vegas, going out to dinner, and there's lots of places in Vegas for dinners, and which is pretty much our entertainment off, you know, when we go off on with ourselves.
You don't go on benders. You don't go like, let's drink the town dry, any of that kind of stuff.
Right? I'm getting a little too long in the tooth for that. So.
No, you never. Not in Vegas, man. Vegas, anything goes.
Well, it's like, you know, we're there to work, and that's what we do. So it's, you know, it's and believe it or not, you know, we work hard, we play hard, but you know.
So
when we get back, we're tired.
So now, how many conventions do you do a year? Is they just do a couple? Do you do like the whole circuit, or?
Well, I used to do a lot. Well, not a lot more, but I used to do probably between 10 and 12 a year.
Wow.
But that's, you know, some of them are longer than others. Now, probably maybe 6 a year is my average.
Okay.
But that includes, you know, maybe going a week or 2 weeks to Australia, New Zealand, or going a week to Germany or a week to England. So it turns out it's not just a 3-day weekend or 4-day weekend. Sometimes it's a full week and traveling long distances and, you know, trying to get your, you know, if I do Australia, I try to get in there 2 or 3 days earlier. To just, you know, try to get used to the hours and the time zones.
Right, right. Now, do these guys, they fly you in and they put you up? They do the whole nine yards for you, or is that?
Yeah. It's, you know, we've been to, John and I have been, oh, I've probably been there one other time more, but John and I have been there at least 2 or 3 times to Australia. Once on a trip to Australia, New Zealand, many times to Germany, France once or twice, all over Europe once or twice.
Wow.
The Netherlands, England a lot, Ireland. So we get around, and I think everybody associated, the actors, all of us, not all of us do it, but most of us do it. And many of us do it, and most of us enjoy it too. I mean, if we didn't enjoy it, we wouldn't do it. So
yeah,
that's what it comes down to. And yeah, people take care of us, and the fans are, you know, fabulous to us. And it's right now we don't have a Star Trek show. The film's coming out soon, or the film is out actually, and the a new TV show, but in the particularly the years that we don't have shows going on, then you know, it's a lot of fun, you know, reliving it and you know, and talking to fans and the ideal, you know, I think it's really a cultural thing at this point, and the culture started in the 60s.
Yeah.
To look at what the world could be. Because we were early in space then, and you know, it's utopian, and it's but utopia, even in technological terms, is
coming true. You know, they had the cell phone on Star Trek way before we had it in our hands, you know, mm-hmm. and you know, many of the things, hopefully the human element will be the same eventually, but I think we're a little slower than technology.
Yeah. Let me. I want to keep on drilling down here a little bit about these conventions a little bit, because you're sort of, is there a pecking order there? Like, as far as like, are there like, oh, like here comes this guy, here comes that guy? Is there like a social stratification, you know, between people? Or is everyone's like, hey, we're all in this together, man? Like, there's, you know, there's.
Well, I think there's the element of how we treat each other and how the world treats us.
Yeah.
And I think that's true wherever you go, whatever you do. If you're politicians and you're in the Senate and the Congress, I don't think they, you may treat the president a little bit differently, they themselves, but I
right.
think between Congress and the Senate, they treat it, you know, pretty much the same, although we as citizens think of the senators as a little bit greater, or more important, or more select group, however you want to phrase it, or even a group that you want to dislike more. I don't know, you know, whatever your play is on it. But the same thing goes with us. I think within, we've all been Screen Actors Guild members, mm-hmm. and we're all union members, and we're all sort of equal on equal basis. However, the social atmosphere of the fans or of the producers or whoever makes the shows, that they are the ones who create the pecking order, and that's pretty obvious what it is.
Okay.
I don't really have to go into what it is, but you know, it's just, it is what it is. But among I have tremendous respect for all the actors in Star Trek.
Sure.
It's pretty much equal basis. The elders a little bit more, you know, I think, mm-hmm. and that's to be expected. They've been through a lot more. They've seen a lot more.
50 years. I mean, you know, it's...
Yeah, exactly. And tremendous respect for, you know, all of them, really. You know, it's an honor to be with this group of actors who, you know, are fabulous, fabulous presence, fabulous, you know, performers, fabulous actors. You know, many of them have, you know, done Shakespeare, and a lot of the Star Trek actors have done Shakespeare. A lot of us are from theater backgrounds. So that in itself says what it is. You know, to me, theater is like, and sometimes it's not just theater. It's, you know, people who are performers, that, you know, have been on a stage, who know what it's like, it's a great group of friends and actors, and, we've now known each other for long time.
25 years at least. I mean, you know.
Yeah, with me anyway. And,
yeah.
And some a lot more than that, some 50 years, when you're talking about the original. I was an original fan of the original show, so.
Oh, okay.
You know, I've been on both sides of the coin.
Tell me about the audition. Tell me about the audition a little bit for getting Gowron. Let's just jump into that a little bit.
Well, it was, you know, I had actually done a show that was, I played a gangster. I think his character's name was Scarface. It wasn't a very big role, but it was a good role. And there was some problem, and not with me, but there was a problem with the script or production or something. And they cut down the role tremendously, and the scenes tremendously, and they loved what I did. And I found out late, almost right away, that it wasn't me. It was just the, you know, what happens in our business sometimes. And
they wanted me back to do another role. So I just kept auditioning and not getting anything. I think I auditioned about 9 or 10 times.
Wow.
Even for things that were close to me, and I just didn't hit. I was like, which, you know, just happens.
Yeah.
It was not normal for me because I was used to getting, career-wise, I probably got about, I would say, almost 20 to 30% of my auditions, which is a pretty high rate for an actor.
Yeah, let me go back here because I'm looking at your IMDb, and I'm an actor too, Robert, just so you know. I'm here in the Valley acting away as well. But your pre-Star Trek IMDb is certainly significant and impressive. I'm listing off a couple things you did. You did Fantasy Island. You did T.J. Hooker. So you already have your Star Trek II connection right there. Manimal, Riptide. I mean, this is like Sledgehammer. You just have Max Headroom. So many cool 80s shows. You are like the epitome of the 80s. Character actor. You just plowed through all these shows, and if you got 30%, I completely believe it, because you cut a swath through here, and then you hit Star Trek.
Right. Well, you know, some of it's a little bit of a cheating thing. I was let you in on what actually happened within the business. I did a show called Hill Street Blues.
And, right.
The role was, and it was funny, it was a time when the audience for Hill Street Blues was not huge. It was to get huge later on, but I think I was in the second season, or maybe, I don't know when it was. But once I did the role, I did a really good job on the role. It was a fabulous role. It was a real cameo that was noticeable, and you know, I did well in it. And instantly, I was well known in the business.
Ah.
I was like, so I could, but when I say in the business, it was like all the casting directors knew me.
Sure,
All the producers knew me. Everybody within our business, and everybody watched Hill Street because it was such a revolutionary series. I mean, it was unique. So anytime I went in, they already knew me.
Sure, yeah.
And it was like, even had situations where they said, well, you're not really right for this. Is there another role you'd like to read for? And I would do that and get, I think that actually happened in T.J. Hooker. I did 2 T.J. Hookers, and I think that actually happened in one of them. And, you know, it was, so that helped me a lot in the 80s.
Now,
the 90s became different because it was a different era.
Right, you know, right.
And I was on a different level too. So
now, in T.J. Hooker, you worked with Shatner. Does he remember you in those episodes when you bump into him at the con?
I don't think he does because you're doing. I think T.J. Hooker was about 5 seasons.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if it went 7, but I think it went 5 at least. And you know, you're doing. In those days, you didn't have such a large cast. You know, he had.
Adrian Zemed.
Probably around 4 or 5 around him.
Yeah.
And that was normal. So you would get the guest stars, you'd get about 6 or 7 guest stars.
Right.
Maybe 5, but at least 5 and 7. So every week, you know, you'd be having another group come in. So I don't think he remembers me at all. I remember him very well, obviously, because I was never nervous around any, quote, star. I'd worked with Carol O'Connor. I worked with, Brian Keith. I'd worked with all these names that, you know, I should have been very nervous with, but I wasn't. But I got around Shatner, and I was terribly nervous. And whether he recognized it or not, I don't know. But he was extremely kind, and not every name does this on sets. He said, well, "How about if we run lines together?"
And really?
I said, And I was never used to that. That was not something that happened in our business.
Yeah.
I said, absolutely. And so we started, and I realized how nervous I really was because I had trouble with my first couple of lines. But after, you know, we ran it for a while, it was fine, and then we shot the scenes. But, you know, that's how nice he was. And he, you know, and wonderful and generous. So, you know, an actor does that with another actor who's a younger actor, you know, it's just fabulous. So, you know, he was truly generous.
That's interesting. You know, Eddie Paskey, who played his stand-in and also Lieutenant Leslie in the original series, he had very similar things to say when I talked to him. Just a very kind and you know, someone who... And Shatner has this sort of, like, persona, this sort of baggage with him that he was not good to work with on camera. And yet, this is, you're the second person I've heard that said, no, he's actually really nice to work with. So,
Well, you know, everybody goes through, you know, I've heard terrible stories about a lot of different actors through the years. And, you know, sometimes one little thing happens and it's magnified because your name is famous.
Yeah.
I think I was pretty good all my career. If I did have any problems, you know, if my name was larger than it was, it would have been magnified if I had a problem on a set or something.
Sure,
like that.
Sure, yeah, that's the price of fame.
And, you know, and things do happen on sets that are, the larger the name, the more needy people are around you. And it, for an actor trying to concentrate, that can be an irritant, you know, because we're there to work in a very sort of calm atmosphere and just do the work. And I remember somebody ordering me around when I was a young actor, and I was doing the best I could because it was a very unusual direction. And Barbara Hershey stood up for me and looked at the who was speaking to me and said, "What is his name?" And the other guy didn't get it. And she said, "What is his name?" And he got it. And he said, "Sir," to me.
Oh.
And, you know, if I ever worked with Barbara Hershey, I would send her flowers every day. because, you know, she said it to me. Now, if you're on the other side of the coin, you know, you might say, oh, that she was being nasty to somebody. No, she was not being nasty. It's viewpoints. It's like she was telling that guy, no, know your place and be polite to everybody, you know, which is what the guy needed to hear because that's the way a set works. So,
yeah,
you know, it really, you know, sometimes we often get bad raps is what I'm saying, you know, and not deserved.
Sure, sure. Sometimes deserved, sometimes not. But it's But it's good. It's good to hear that you know that sometimes the veil is lifted by you, and we see that you know some people are better than not. Okay,
yeah.
So you're playing Gowron.
Right.
Let's dig into that a little bit because you know I went back and I just watched a whole bunch of your performances and they're fabulous. You know Like I don't know if anyone really nailed Klingons in Next Generation until you showed up, and I'm just gonna say that, and maybe I'm in trouble for that or whatever, but I think you hit that perfect balance between the like let's just kill everything and Worf's kind of brooding, you know, maudlin, you know, I'm sort of a Klingon, sort of not, and you came in and you just owned every scene. It felt like to me, What brought you to that point? Like you charged in so fearlessly with a bunch of people who have been on the show for 4 years already. What was that like? What was your prep for playing this role?
Well, first of all, it was frightening, but you can't be frightened as a Klingon. And the director who hired me was Jonathan Frakes.
Oh, okay.
And Jonathan was instrumental in creating Gowron. I mean, he was the one who said, no, I want you to do the eyes all the time. later on, I had to fight with every director to get the eyes in, you know.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, he was absolutely right about that. He also allowed me, I'm a big believer in not cutting yourself off to certain aspects of what I consider generalities. I'm sort of an old I don't know how to explain it without getting esoteric, but what? But you use yourself, and I have, if anybody has ever been with me for any length of time, 5 minutes, knows that I have a pretty good sense of humor. And I didn't want that taken out of a Klingon just because I was a Klingon. I wanted that to be, because I think humor is in a large part shows intelligence, and I think the Klingon Empire was intelligent, and I just felt that a lot of people came in and grunted and groaned and yelled, and that is part of being a Klingon too. But I didn't want, you know, I wanted to make sure that part of what Klingons were intelligent, so I just brought humor to the character, and Jonathan allowed me to do that, and I think was very much for it. He encouraged me a lot to go for it as far as I could, and I can go pretty far, but he had a lot of trust in me and a lot of faith, and he encouraged me, and that gave, and actually that was, it got to be a through line anyway through it, and I did my homework because I was able to do my homework in the beginning. I brought a Shakespearean background, a basic, because the basic characters were very, very similar.
Yeah.
From a character I'd done in Lear, Edmund in Lear.
Right.
Outsiders coming in, sort of being orphans, illegitimate children, sort of, and putting a lot of the same things. At the same time, the physicality I worked on a tremendous amount, which did not come out in the script ever, but as acting, quote, homework, it did, you know, in dimensions.
Well, you can see, I mean, like, between you and Duras, you know, you have a far more, like, a vertical approach to it. You're a lot more stiff and regal in some ways. You know, whereas Duras is kind of slouching, and Worf is kind of also kind of vertical too, but he's also a little more wooden, I would say. Shakespearean is a great term for it, because you really just launch yourself into this, and really, I mean, you know, for me, and I'm sure everyone tells you this, you know, when you say you will die slowly, Duras, just the intensity you gave with that eye pop, and I have giant eyes too. I mean, like, I have really big eyes too, and that books me a lot of work, and I'm not afeard of that. So you're on set and you're just like, and I don't want to, like, I will say, how can I say, you're being very, I want to say chewing the scenery, but in the most positive way. You're not taking offense to that, right? If I say that, because it was so delicious to watch you go through there, and Next Generation had such a placid tone to it, and you come in and you are literally, you're almost flipping tables. You are so alive in those scenes, and it's like, whoa, look at that guy. How did the rest of the cast react to that?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you know, all I know is, you know, a lot of this, I can't take credit for. A lot of it comes from, you know, Frakes encouraging me, and the writers actually seeing some of it and giving me the original, you know, role, but also seeing what I did and then being able to write for it.
Right, yeah.
And so that was like just a gift, you know, that they kept giving me, and it was just wonderful to have. I mean, the first one, was that Sinza's father? No, it wasn't. No, I always get the names wrong, so ignore me on that. But the first one that I did, that was the script that we got, and it was
reunion.
I was told a lot of what Gowron was, and I filled in the blanks. But
right
after that, I think they looked at what I did, and you know, working with Patrick is like, you know, gosh, it was funny. We were in some ways we're very similar. He's so fast, you know, I mean that in a complimentary way. He's very, very quick. But in the morning when our mouths are slurred, we would find each other behind the sets going through our alphabets and vowels and consonants and doing it in the same method, which is I thought was hilarious. You know, you go, and it's like... And so we were both laughing at each other at one point, you know, because, you know, we kind of the same school in some ways. And so, you know, we enjoyed each other. I just love the guy working with him. He was just the best. Michael Dorn, same. You know, it's like everybody I was working with. I didn't work with a lot of the cast,
the TNG cast. Yeah.
It was really... Patrick and Michael Dorn and through the years, and that was pretty much it. I might have a scene with the doctor, or you know, but they were very short and very so it, you know, working with the people that I worked with, even in when we moved over to Deep Space, was equally wonderful. Although it was, at that point, I think it was, you know, it was getting harder for me to do it as I was getting older.
The physical demands on you were a little tougher?
Well, no, the physical demands were always tough. I mean, you were losing 8 to 10 pounds a day.
Wow.
In liquids.
Sign me up.
In your body. Wow. And sets were hot. Costume was broiling. Air made it worse. We put in, Klingons put in 16-hour days.
Yeah.
There was at one point where I was doing a play at the same time.
Oof.
So it was, you know, it got, you know, grueling as the older you get. You know?
Yeah.
I did it over 10 years.
Wow.
So I started in my 40s and went into my 50s.
Wow. Well, I was, you know, it's funny, and I was watching, like I said, a couple of the episodes, and I hadn't watched some of these episodes in HD, and particularly it was funny to watch, because there was a couple of fights you had with Worf, where suddenly a stuntman appeared where you were. This is correct, right? They had stuntmen doing the fights.
Sure.
Yeah. And when it was in regular definition, it was all good, but all of a sudden high definition, like, that is not Gowron. I'm sorry, but that is another dude... fighting all of a sudden.
Oh, you could tell in the high def.
You can, yeah. It's really weird. I mean, the original series, you could tell even in standard def. You're like, that is not Captain Kirk. That is like some dude with a wig. But yeah. This, the first time ever, I was like, I wonder if they do their own stunts. And I'm watching, like, no, look at that. There's particular moments where you see your stunt double switch in. So.
Do you remember what show it was? Just curious.
Oh, gosh. It was.
It's okay.
No, I think it was, let's see, it was the one where you push Worf through. I think it might be the last one, where Worf kills you.
Okay. Well, that was sort of they ran out of time, so we actually didn't do our own stunts.
Okay.
And they had to, it was the last day of that shoot,
mm-hmm.
and they were locking up at 2 a.m., and so they... We wanted to do it, both Michael and I wanted to do it, and
right.
We objected a little bit, but we were overruled. You know, they have to close up when they have to close up.
Yeah, yeah.
Another day's work, and
only the stunt guys did the fight that day, and it was we were disappointed because it was my last show, so I was doubly disappointed. I wanted to do my own stuff, and that happens, you know.
Yeah.
Normally it doesn't, but there's the one where Worf and I, you know, Worf and I fought a number of times.
You did, yeah.
To a draw, and that one we didn't, but there was the other one where we had the fight was
with fake Martok.
Yeah, when Martok becomes the whatchamacallit.
The changeling, yeah. And he whips his little tentacles.
And that was, you know, that was, we did a lot of our own stuff, but the stunt guys did, they always do the entire fight without stopping. We go in, we do like three or four, you know, moves, and then turn the camera around and then continue, but we did the, you know, the entire thing, stop and go, and they do, you know, the stunt guys always do the majority of the work.
Sure, sure.
But it gives them more editing, more ability to cut, and hide the fact that stunt guys are in there at certain times. And
yeah. You know, I don't mind it because, like, we're in an age now where, like, if they wanted to, they could, like, in, you know, the 21st century, they could just, you know, take your face and put it on that stunt guy and you're fighting. And I like it, you know, because in the past, they couldn't do that. So in the 10th or 20th view, if I'm watching, I'm like, oh, that's a stunt guy. Like, suddenly I get it. And it's like an extra Easter egg for someone who's really, really attached to the show. You know, so there's, you know, it's completely fine. I like it.
Yeah, it would be fun, and you know, to see that. I particularly like, they sent me a few of them. And the very first one I enjoy a lot because the original filming sort of covered up the original look of when I was next to Patrick, the original shot. The original film didn't show it very clearly. It was too dark. But when they remastered it, it's perfect. And it's just, it's kind of my favorite shot of all time. It's me and Patrick right next to each other.
Oh, wow.
And, it's kind of eerie. It's fun.
That's great. That's amazing. You talked a little bit about Deep Space Nine, and I read a quote from you, which I agree with 100%, and I'm going to read it, about Gowron. You say, remember the way Gowron came in is not the way he went out. He went out as this bad, terrible Klingon, which I disagreed with strongly, but that's fine. But that's not fine, because I think they kind of messed up Gowron a little bit. And I don't know what your feelings are on that, but that, and I'm willing to lead the charge on that, because when I saw that last episode where you died, it was such a ridiculous way of just tying off all those ends so that, you know, Worf could become Chancellor if he wanted to, or Martog. And it took a great character in Gowron and just turned him into a little bit of an idiot, a little bit of a, you know, kind of a headstrong idiot, where up to this point he had been a tactical politician. So I don't know if you still stand by those ideas or where you're at.
Well, it's the dilemma of a show, and what writers have and what producers have and how they want to, you know, if you say, okay, we want to end the show. We want to end the show. Okay, that's 7 years and mm-hmm. and it's time to end the show. Now somebody decides, and whoever it is, you know, decides, okay, well, let's tie up all the ends of all the characters. I mean, I don't know if you saw Downton Abbey, but, you know, they all of a sudden they tied up all the ends and made everybody sweet and nice at the end.
My wife told me that, yeah. So she told me that.
Which is not really what the show had ever been about.
No.
They listened to the fans, and the fans wanted, you know, it all to be sweet and nice at the end. And then they did it, and they did it, you know, fairly well. And pretty much the same thing goes for what was going on Deep Space Nine. They were trying to, they were tying the whole show up. I think their reasoning, although I don't know their reasoning for it, I think the reasoning was, for my character, was that absolute power corrupts absolutely.
And so I just think they did it too quickly.
Yeah.
If they were going to do it at all. So I was very thankful because I got three shows out of it. I can't, that was a wonderful time for me to just be working. So
sure, sure.
And so in that sense, I'm very thankful. Logistically not logistically, that's the wrong word, but trying to motivate reasoning for my character to behave the way he did became more difficult for me because I didn't feel like the motivation was there, but that's the actor's job.
Yeah.
So it's not our job to question why. It's for us to do or die. And so... to me it was the corruption was internal, not shown, and that had to become my motivation.
Right.
And pretty much in terms of jealousy and somebody else getting attention, where I wanted the attention. Stuff
right.
Like that. But it didn't really, it didn't, to me, there was... I don't feel I ever did a great job with it, but, then again, I didn't have a lot of time to develop that either, so...
I think you did a great job. I mean, because even if we go back to your first appearance in Deep Space Nine, I mean, you were used more as a tool of the plot than to build your own character. I mean, you had to come in there, bring in Worf, and then establish the whole Klingon war, like, in an episode. I mean, like, it was such a hard left turn, and you had to justify that.
I mean, that's our job anyway. I mean,
sure.
Actors in TV shows, that we thrust through the, we make it, the writers write it, and we just hop on the train and make it happen. So, that kind of aspect... I was fine with and happy to be there and happy to doing with it. I thought I did okay. I was just, and actually I thought it was, a lot of fun, continuing the fun sort of, the Klingon Empire.
Oh, yeah.
A little bit of chaos here, but, that's part of the Klingon Empire.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
You guys brought the party. I mean, every other... species in the quadrant were so, they're such milquetoasts, and you guys are cutting your hands and drinking wine out of it. I mean, this is the place I want to hang out, right? I mean,
well, we were, in a sense, we were the party humans,
Yes, that's exactly right.
But I gotta tell you, I loved so many aspects of Deep Space because it was the aliens were like, anywhere from creepy to geniuses to sloths to, Machiavellian, just beyond belief of the Wayun. I mean, I howled at some of this stuff that was just, I just thought it was brilliant. Some of the actors are just off the charts,
Oh, yeah. We think Deep Space Nine has the best character actors, and they just took control of the show, basically. That's what... I mean, you guys and JG and everyone there, just all the great character actors of the 90s just unleashed to, act up a storm. And you were right there at the front, leading the Klingon charge.
Well, we were, thank you. We were, it's like, I was watching, quote, as a fan, some of the acting going on, and it was just so much fun. Thinking particularly of watching Jeffrey Combs, it was just, he would die and then he would come right back a minute later and I'd be in hilarity, He was just, I don't know, it just went on and on and on.
Yeah.
It was great. It was a fun show. And both shows were totally different.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed both of them. I just, I wish I was on a little bit more in Deep Space, but,
you know, that's, you know, it is the way it was, and that's the way it was. You know?
Is there ever any, I mean, you're friends with JG, is there ever any sort of moment where you wish that, it's like, you know, because he became sort of the default Klingon mentor for the next, like, you know, two or three seasons. Was there ever a part saying, you know, I started this thing, I should be in this more? Did, like, you know, like a little bit of professional jealousy or just like a little tinge where it's like, oh, why, I, you know, they could use me so much more.
Not really. Never. It never got that way because it was, I already done, how many years? About 5 or 6 years on Next Gen.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was, by the time, I forget the years. Would you remember the years of Next Gen?
It was 87 to 93, I believe.
Okay. 93. And then we went in, and there was a, they went over each other for a couple of years. And all of a sudden I ended up, you know, doing both at the same time, practically.
Right.
But what a lot of people don't realize, I was doing a lot of other stuff as a Klingon, too. I would do 3 weeks on a shoot with Frakes doing a VCR, and then I did another week or two on another show playing a Klingon. So I was, like, working constantly. And although I wanted to be in Deep Space Nine, I was very happy not to be in Deep Space Nine because I could do other work, I could go other places.
Yeah.
And then in 97, when did Deep Space Nine end? What year?
I believe it was 99.
Yeah, in 97 I had the birth of all my children, and that became impossible, literally impossible.
Wait, you had the birth of all your children? Is that what you said, or?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah, well, my wife had triplets.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it just became difficult to do anything. And at that point, I was like, okay, I've had enough.
Yeah.
And doing a show or so, you know, was fine. But I was not, you know, and I was doing some films at the same time prior to that.
Yeah.
So I was more into working, going on the road, working, and then when the kids happened, I was like, okay, I actually had to stop working entirely.
Yeah.
For 9 months is basically, I had to not work, and I had to turn down work.
Because of the kids?
Because of them, yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah.
So that it just became difficult, and I would have liked, but competition between JG and I are like, it's non-existent, never was, in terms of me, we did shows together. I thought they were really good shows.
Yeah.
We didn't have a lot of scenes together, strangely enough, but, but it was, you know, it was fine. I probably would have wanted a couple of more shows, but not around that time, not towards the end. And then all of a sudden I got 3 shows in a row, and that was like, that was great, because I know there's an end to it.
Yeah. Is there ever a time when you look at your work on Star Trek and say, this has been more... because some of the other, like the original cast members say, like, this for a while it was a drag on their career, that's all they're known for. Have you ever had that sense where it's like, oh, I'm just Gowron?
Or... No, because it's just the opposite, because nobody knew who the hell I was. some people thought I dropped out of the business. I would show up at the producer's audition and they say, where you been? And, you know, it's like, oh, well, I've been around, you know, I've been working, you know. And, you know, I think sort of what happened to me was I got very comfortable. I was directing a lot of plays then. I was doing a lot of plays at the same time. And I got very comfortable doing Star Trek shows, not being hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And because I was doing my plays and doing my directing, and being very happy with that lifestyle. and every once in a while I'd be doing films. So I wasn't as hungry as I had been. But that was my own choice and decision. I've always been sort of after the work and not after the, you know, the name stuff, the, you know, stardom stuff. It's sort of unimportant to me, always was.
Let me ask this real quick. I mean, because I don't know, the convention circuit is sort of fascinating to me a little bit. Do you make a living off of this? I don't need to know numbers, but is this like, are you comfortable just doing conventions, or is it just something you do just to travel? I don't know.
No, I mean, we do make an income from it, but it's not huge.
Okay.
But it's a, you know, it adds to,
okay,
know, whatever we do. I'll be doing this year. I'm be doing actually next month. I go to England and I do Birmingham and
right.
London, and then in January I'll be doing the cruise that's sort of just been announced. So
oh wow,
the Star Trek cruise. So yeah, it adds to our incomes, and it's really nice at my age to have that.
Sure.
It's a supplemental income, and I did retire from acting a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And I might go back to it. I kind of doubt it.
Now, why have you done that? What was the impetus to do that?
I just got tired of doing it.
Yeah.
I got tired of. I don't want to do theater anymore. Sort of burnt out on that. And I did a lot of it, and I would direct again. That's something I would do, but I don't go out for it. I don't, you know, run around to try to get it. In our business, you have to if you want to do it. You know?
Yeah.
I'm like, don't push for it. And really what I want to do is write, and I've spent my whole time, you know, a whole sort of career just wanting to finally sit down and write. So that's what I do.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
You know, and you know, I write plays. I don't write screenplays. I just write plays.
Good.
That's what I want. So I'm happy with, you know, what's going on. My kids are all in college. It's a little difficult nowadays, but conventions help a lot that way. So.
That's great. I think, for like fans hearing that, I mean, and, you know, certainly you watch, you know, your old shows, you know, any TV show you watch and you see these people, there's this hope that the people who you grew up with, you know, that either through residuals or whatever, that you're sort of taken care of as you go, you get, you know, kind of go into your own like residual Stovall core kind of thing. You know, that, you know, and so it's nice to know that like, that these things are actually providing you and many other Star Trek people who we've grown up and loved, you know, as with an additional income. That's, you know, that's a great trade-off, I think. You know, you get to be in Star Trek and you get a little bit of income.
Well, it, you know, it's in many ways, we all know that we caught the golden ring, you know.
Yeah.
Actors don't always have this. In our business, we do. I belong to three unions, and that takes care of me to a certain degree.
Sure.
Screen Actors Guild, which is now the same as AFTER, but it used to be two different, but now they're combined, and Actors Equity Association, which is the theater wing of our unions. And so I'm taking care of it, and a lot of us are, but by doing the conventions, you know, we have caught the golden ring. I mean, that's the, I don't think there is any other show in the world that we can say that about that has helped actors for so many years. And it's wonderful to have, and it's wonderful to have the fans. And above all, I think Star Trek actors appreciate the fans, because that's really what keeps us all going, not in terms of the convention, but in terms of the conventions, but also in terms of the whole philosophy and what Roddenberry created. And, you know, Star Trek itself is just off the charts.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's great. My friend, I asked a bunch of friends, I said, you know, give me a bunch of questions to ask Robert. And most of them are completely ridiculous, but this one actually makes me laugh. He asks, who was the smelliest Klingon?
I don't know. I didn't run into any.
There were no smelly Klingons on set, or like, I mean, there was...
Well, even if there were, I wouldn't say so.
You have too much honor to disclose that. That is what it is. Oh, that's...
Yeah, well, for all I know, it may have been me. You know,
oh, yeah, maybe. No, they had you back. If, you know, if you were the smelliest, they wouldn't have you back, right? I mean, you're like, ooh, let's not bring that guy back.
I don't know.
Oh, wow. Well, Robert, this has been great. We're wrapping up, but I want to ask you another quick thing. You know, this has been the 50th anniversary, obviously, of Star Trek, you know, and
right.
Like for me, this has been me living my I've been going through my Star Trek midlife crisis, and I've been kind of doing everything Star Trek, and I did something you did a couple years ago, which is I traveled to Riverside, Iowa for their Trek Fest.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and I'm looking at a picture right now of you and JG on a float throwing out candy. Now, isn't that the most adorable town and festival you've ever been at?
Well, you know, there's two great towns. Iowa, that Riverside in Iowa.
Uh-huh.
And another town called Vulcan in Canada.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Where they actually have a mock-up of the Enterprise ship.
Yeah.
But the two towns, and they have a parade also. We've done that, too.
Oh, okay.
And they're just small towns. And, you know, Riverside is the place where
Kirk.
Captain Kirk is going to be born in about 200 years, you know.
Yeah.
So, and they, you know, they have a little plaque there. And we want to go back. We're trying to get back there, and we probably will.
Oh, good.
Fairly soon. Hopefully next year we're going to be going back there.
Oh, good.
So it's, we love the place. We love the people there.
It's so nice.
John and I like to go to large conventions, medium conventions, and very, very small conventions. You know, that was sort of a small venue, but we had a hoot and a holler. we sort of rented out a bar there and had a band and sang there and then had a parade the next day. It was just, you know, we had a fabulous, fabulous time.
It is a great, I mean, I went there. They didn't have any special guest stars that year. And
right.
I was from Los Angeles, and I was dressed up as Captain Kirk, so I marched in the parade as Captain Kirk. So I was about the closest thing they had to being a celebrity, which was great. And I shook everyone's hands. They didn't know who I was or what I was doing. But,
right.
You know, it reminds you, like, at the base, like, what it's all about when you just see, you know, people, you know, just kind of coming in from Ames, Iowa, or Des Moines, and they're just here to share things, you know, and it's such a great Americana moment.
Yeah, it is, and you know, Star Trek is so unique and so wonderful. You know, it's it shows us the way. You know, that's what I like about it. So
yeah,
you know, it's been good. You know, in many different ways, and continues to be so.
Wow.
It was great to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. Yeah, it's I appreciate it. Is there any, like how would, like, let's, if we do a tiny bit of improv, like, how would Gowron sign off from a podcast like this? Like, what would he say if I said, well, Gowron, it's been great to talk to you.
It's very simple.
Yeah.
Kapla.
Oh, listen to that. And I can hear your eyes, Robert. I can hear them. They're so good. So good, Robert. You are the savior of Klingon. You don't know that, but maybe you do, but you have dispensed glory to us and our house. Oh, so good. Well, Robert, we're somewhat close neighbors. I hope I bump into you someday, and we can share a slice of pizza or something like that. But thank you so much for being on this podcast. This has been so exciting.
Alrighty.
And yeah, maybe I'll see you around at the next convention or who knows where out there.
Sounds good.
All right. Robert, have a great day, and I'll talk to you soon.
See you in Vegas.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
How about that? Gowron. Let me try again. Gowron. There we go. You will die. Slowly, Duras. So good. He's a nice guy. You know, that's the thing, all these guys, you know, and he must be like 65 now, and they're all just nice guys, and look back at it with just such a nice warm glow, and there's no like, oh man, it ruined my career, and like that, and Shatner's an asshole. No, he's a good guy. That was nice. That was unexpected. A pleasant present here on this Thursday. I don't know if it's Thursday for you. I don't care that much. But we are moving forward. You hear that? We got Gowron. We are moving up the ladder. We're going to get to the big star soon because it's inevitable. It's their destiny. They're going to have to talk to me, and they're going to have to listen to me. I have a cold. I'm not afraid to mention that now that Gowron's not here. He would have slit my throat because there's no honor in having a cold or a virus. You just power through that, which I did. I did. My God, I'm going through double puberty. That's okay. You stay with us. Because we don't stop. We are as constant as the Northern Star. My name is Mike McCafferty, and I just want to talk about Star Trek.
Destruct sequence completed and engaged.
Don't you understand?
Error, flaw, imperfection.
When the train comes in, everybody rides.
Blah, 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 blah.
Oh, I'd be very glad to do that, Mr. Spock.
Hello, I'm Dave Ross.
Hey, and I'm Hampton Yunt.
And we host Suicide Buddies on Starburns Audio.
That's right. It's a podcast about suicide, but not to make light of it. We actually talk about suicidal thoughts, depression, kind of with a sense of levity that Dave and I have with each other. He's my best friend. Come on.
Yeah, we're buddies. Suicide Buddies.
That's the title.
One of our favorite episodes that we've recorded so far is about this guy, Jan Patocki, who was a Polish aristocrat in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And he, one of the reasons it's possible that he killed himself is that he thought he was a werewolf.
Oh.
Check out a clip. It also makes me think, like, we were talking about in the Norway black metal episode, how, like, just the culture of your surroundings can affect you. Like, yeah. He's in a castle in Poland. He's like, I mean, if you lived in a castle in Poland and no one knew anything about anything, you might be like, I'm a bat. I'm probably a bat.
That's like literally what happened to Batman. He literally is in his mansion. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I'm a bat.
I'm a
bat that helps people.
I'm a bat that helps people.
I'm a rich.
I don't know what you want from me. And my girlfriend, she's a cat. She's a cat.
My girlfriend's a cat.
She steals things. She's a woman who steals things. She's a cat. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I help people. She's a cat. We fight a penguin.
My